Carjacked, The Culture of the Automobile and Its Effect on Our Lives is the new book co-authored by today's guest, Ann Fernandez. The book is published by Palgrave Macmillan. You write, Ann, that our romance with the automobile is now being seriously challenged. What's going on?
Well, quite a few things. When I began the research on the book in 2006, we were in the midst of our biggest automotive binge ever. But as our research continued, we saw a shift even before 2008 in some of the interviews that we were doing just with ordinary American drivers and car owners who were becoming frustrated with traffic and the costs of keeping their cars. But then the gas spike of 2008 and growing awareness of the threat of global warming really made 2008, in our minds, a tipping point that caused people to start to become, for the first time in a couple of decades, interested in fuel efficiency in vehicles. The recession came along and taught us a harsh lesson about borrowing, and a lot of folks had been borrowing against home equity to buy automobiles. Some folks found themselves forced onto transit for financial reasons and realized its benefits. Then the auto companies went into bankruptcy, and in 2009 we found polling telling us that the bailouts were even less popular than the bailouts of the Wall Street banks. And I think Americans were realizing how the car companies had sold us on a really irrational exuberance for oversized vehicles to our detriment individually and systemically. And then most recently, obviously, we've seen the Toyota recalls that have reminded us once again of our overdependence on our vehicles and have reminded us of their danger, the daily danger that we put ourselves into when we get into our vehicles. So there's really been a series of hits to the relationship between the public and the automobile.
You assert that the problems created by our car culture in America are much deeper than problems of global warming and our reliance on foreign oil. You just mentioned the debt that we've incurred to buy ever larger automobiles. What are some of the other problems that your research uncovered?
Well, we were surprised really to find that most folks connected car culture problems almost exclusively with our reliance on fossil fuels. And over the course of the years that we did our research, we found people more aware of our dependence on foreign oil, but unfortunately still willing to drill domestically in order to continue to fuel our cars. But what we came to realize in the course of our research is that the costs run far beyond those costs to the environment and to our foreign policy that reliance on oil produces. And some of those costs are financial at the family level and at the national level. Some of them are costs in terms of the amount of time that we're spending in our vehicles, in part due to increasing traffic. And there are costs in terms of our health that are growing, rising rates of asthma, cancer, heart disease, obesity from the sedentary lifestyle that cars foster. And then finally, a largely ignored cost that we've been paying year after year in terms of lives. The rates of fatalities due to automobiles have remained relatively steady for over a decade until really the last 2 years when we finally, as a nation, started to cut down on the number of miles that we've been driving.
The association of the automobile with the American dream has been very strong, even though it, as you say, it may be challenged now, but it's really a big part of our American mythology. How did that happen, and do you think that it is inevitably our continuing story, our continuing description or definition of the American dream?
With the rise of the suburbs, obviously the American dream came to fairly specifically be symbolized by the single-family home and the family car parked in the driveway of that single-family home out in the suburbs. And in recent decades, the dream really expanded to two or more cars, fairly luxurious ones in front of a much larger home. And we can look at the built landscape as one of the reasons for that association, but really we came to understand through the course of our research how powerful automotive advertising and marketing has been to cementing the relationship, so that really city, suburb, or country, the car has come to mean the American dream. And really cars appeal to a set of core American values, like freedom and individualism and the family, but the American dream is central to those American values that the automakers have exploited very successfully in their advertising. So they're values that we really hold, but we associate them more intensely with automobiles because we've absorbed year after year of tens of billions of dollars of automotive advertising devoted to making that connection in our minds. We hope it's not inevitable, and yes, for the challenges that we just discussed, I think are important to breaking down that automatic association. But I think some media literacy is also a helpful tool to breaking down that association, so that if we start to look at the marketing that we're exposed to in a more critical way, in a more conscious way, we can, as individuals and families, particularly with our children who are growing up in a car culture, help them to disconnect those that product and that ideal.
You explore in your book how cars are sold and how we buy them. You also attempt to unravel what we really pay as a society so dependent on its cars. What are the costs?
Well, the financial costs are enormous. At the family level, the average American family spends roughly $14,000 a year to own their average two cars, which doesn't sound like a lot unless you consider that the median household income is $50,000, and that spending then on transportation is a very large chunk, and the biggest chunk after housing. Over the lifetime of car ownership, the average American family may spend up to $1 million owning cars. So if you think of how even taking that number and dividing it in half or cutting it down by a third, the amount of savings that could be put into a college account or to a retirement account is very meaningful. So the financial cost of families are large, and that's not even looking at the amount that's taken out of our paychecks for taxes, because a large chunk of our taxes goes to maintaining the car system and all of its tentacles. But another large cost is in terms of health and life. And as we did our research, some of the most heart-wrenching stories that we heard were from people who were suffering either from lifelong injuries due to crashes, like a 45-year-old we talked to named Tim, who has been living with and being taken care of by his family since his college crash. He's bound to a wheelchair and suffers a variety of medical problems as a result of a crash he had decades ago, to a woman named Mary Ann, who's a toll booth worker who is dying of cancer, quite possibly caused by her exposure, daily exposure to car exhaust on the job. So there are a host of health costs to us that we don't always associate with a car culture.
You blame the car, in part, on rising inequality. Explain the connection between the car and our car culture and rising inequality.
Yes. Well, if you think of that 14,000 number that I mentioned earlier, that it costs to own a car, that's the average cost. For the poor who own a car, the car represents a much bigger chunk of their income, in part due to the fact that their income is smaller, but also because they are often paying more for the very same car that a middle-class family might own. And that happens for a number of reasons. Unfortunately, car dealers and loan officers often tend to see the working poor as easy targets for overpricing. They're more often victim to dealer fraud. And they end up paying higher prices for older cars in poor condition, so they often end up paying higher insurance rates as a result. They often pay higher repair costs. And depending on what zip code they live in, they may pay higher insurance rates just for that reason. Even if they're excellent drivers and have a decent car, they pay higher loan rates than the rest of us if they have less than perfect credit. So the poor own expensive but not necessarily particularly good or reliable cars that they spend a much higher proportion of their income to own and maintain. So if we look at that factor, and then we look at even the middle class, we can say hasn't benefited particularly from the past decade's automotive binge, because we've been paying more and more for increasingly luxurious vehicles crammed with a variety of technical gizmos and packed with horsepower and cargo space. And many middle class families have been paying for these cars with credit, often again with home equity, which has contributed to their household indebtedness. And really the folks who've benefited are a very small crew, the oil and gas company executives, and until recently the executives at the automakers, who've benefited from the money that the rest of us have spent on cars, but also from our tax dollars in the form of fairly huge government subsidies to the oil and gas and automotive industries. And, of course, we're all paying for the bailouts of GM and Chrysler. Finally, money's been flowing upward from millions of American families to the bankers and the lenders and the hedge funds who finance the tens of millions of cars that we've been purchasing each year. So we can absolutely see how the working poor in particular are suffering under the current car system. The middle class hasn't been doing all that well, and there's a handful of very wealthy folks who are making out quite well.
You write in your book, many discretionary trips or added legs, such as driving the children to school, have become normalized to the point of seeming essential, which I thought was a striking observation. How do we turn that around? How do we take something that now seems essential into something that people actually question and devise another solution for?
In our interviews with drivers, we were surprised by how often folks said, well, I don't really have a choice. I have to get to work. And a lot of us assume that much of our driving is as a result of our commutes. And if we can rethink that in a variety of ways, I think we'll be better off. Firstly, realizing that for some of us, our commutes are somewhat in our control. Obviously, during a recession, it's not a good time for people to be changing jobs or changing homes. But when we do have the chance to move or to take a new job, really looking very closely at the commute we're choosing to invest are something that we must do. And people are starting to do. The second point is realizing just how few trips out of each day really are for that necessary commute. The trip to the store, the trip to run to the dry cleaner, the trip to drive the kids to school, or the extra trip to go get a cup of coffee have become so normalized, such a habit, that it's a very unthinking process for most of us. So we're really trying to encourage a sense of mindful driving. If you think about the revolution that's happened in American diets in recent years, we haven't all changed all of our habits, but we've become more mindful of what we do eat and the choices that we do make. And I think that through pursuing mindful driving, thinking about before we get in the car, do I need to take this trip right now? Can I combine this trip later in the week? Do I need to take this trip at all? Are there other alternatives? Can I walk? Is the trip a short one? Many of the trips that we take are walkable or bikeable trips, but because we have a car and we're so used to hopping into it, we don't think twice about doing it.
You include in your book, you close your book with a call to action, and you have a number of personal actions that you recommend. I don't want to talk about those now. We'll let our listeners read those in your book, but you also identify several public policy actions that we should be urging our public officials to take. Describe those recommendations, those public policy recommendations.
Well, we first start by recommending a shift in spending that's already taking place, because huge amount of our budget goes, again, to subsidies, to oil and gas companies, to automotive companies, and to automotive infrastructure. And taking more of those monies and putting them towards creating incentives for less driving. There are a lot of things that municipalities and states around the country have been doing to create incentives for less driving. And I think we can all learn from each other as to how to do that better. One option is encouraging pay-as-you-go insurance, for example, where really drivers are taking control of their spending. It's one of those fixed costs now that are encourage people to say, well, I'm already spending this much money to own my car. I may as well drive it every time I need to go somewhere. So if we can create more incentives for less driving, I think we're going to be really reducing the number of miles that folks are driving. And investing in public transportation. And so it's been certainly a positive sign to see the current administration devoting some of the stimulus monies to high-speed rail projects and to other public transportation projects. But our number one recommendation is that we really pursue a meaningful shift in spending away from the car system and towards public transit. Obviously, more funding and into the research and to incentivizing the production of smaller, greener cars for those people who must have a car, being able to have a choice that is a higher mileage, less polluting vehicle is a goal that we need to pursue. Encouraging higher density planning and development, and generally seeing cars as one part of a more flexible, equitable, and practical transportation mix, seeing cars as part of the mix and not the dominant go-to transportation form is something that we're looking for our politicians and our leaders to be re-envisioning. We also do make some recommendations for families and individuals to do that same kind of re-envisioning and see their own car as part of a transportation mix and not the dominant way that they get around.
We've been talking to Ann Fernandez. She is co-author of Carjacked, The Culture of the Automobile and Its Effect on Our Lives. Ann, thanks so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.